The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, another big weekend in the top flight with some big results at both ends of the table.
Yes, some massive results. I think collectively last week we all rolled out of Vigalta and Oita, so obviously they went on and won because that's what the J-League does. And yeah, there were some cracking results. Avispa Fukuoka were absolutely unbelievable, but yeah, we'll get into them later on. But yeah, it was another really exciting weekend in the J-League.
Absolutely. And yes, before we get into all of that, we have a lot to chat about with this week's guest. We wanted to give him a bit of time to decompress after he was flat out during the Olympics and most of the Paralympics, but with the WE League, the first ever fully professional women's football league in Japan, launching over the weekend, it was the perfect time to send out the bat signal from the Japan Times and the soon-to-be-launched J-Talk After Dark podcast. It's Dan Orlowitz. Dan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm good. In the words of Thomas Jefferson in Hamilton, what I miss. It's been quite a while, hasn't it?
Most definitely, Dan. So yeah, we spoke at the end of June, obviously before the Olympics really got going. And at that time, you told us that you were only accredited for football at Saitama Stadium, but the people who follow you on Twitter, or indeed, check out the Japan Times online or in print form, certainly found out that you did venture elsewhere during the Olympic fortnight. So obviously, we don't want to go through day by day, but you were in such a fortunate position to be a sports reporter while the Olympics were on in the country you reside in. So I guess just some overall thoughts about how the 2 weeks of the Olympics went for you, and just what an overall what an experience it was for you.
I mean, it was certainly an unforgettable experience. I think that, as we all know, the fact that they went on without fans, it did sort of reduce the hype and the atmosphere a bit at Saitama. There were sort of crowds of reporters, certainly, especially during Japan's games, but Saitama was rather remote. You didn't have the fans turning up to just sort of chill outside as you did at some of the urban sport venues, at the national stadium where the athletics were held. So it was a different Olympic experience, but, to get the badge is an honor. To be able to cover the games in any form is a privilege, and it was a very cool thing to do, and I'm really proud of the writing I produced, not just about football, but sort of all the other non-competition stuff and some of the features that I put out.
Despite those lack of crowds, when you attended these events, did it feel like you were attending something special, or did the lack of crowds really take away that from the experience?
I mean, I'll be honest, it did take away. An empty Saitama Stadium, we went over this, especially at the first or second J-League round after COVID and when they played behind closed doors, but it's one thing to have all the stands covered in red and the flat and the Urawa flags and all that sort of thing, and that at least it's something. But an empty Saitama Stadium, just empty, and some of the Olympic bunting and the Tokyo 2020 branding and that sort of thing, it was a bummer. The only times when it felt like there was an atmosphere, I mean, the Japan-Spain semifinal, the Japan-Mexico bronze game, when you had so many Japanese journalists who were there, and volunteers and staff who are in the stands and were allowed to watch in a limited capacity, it did sort of feel at least like a pandemic-era J-League game. But every competition I watched, both the Olympics and Paralympics, I think the biggest thing on your mind is, man, how cool would this have been with a full house? And that's something that was taken from us and something that we can't get back. And we don't need to get into the debate about whether yeah, the game should have been held or whether or not they should have tried to get in fans somehow. But it was a missed opportunity, and it was disappointing in that respect.
So, yeah, I mean, it might have been difficult for you at the time, as you were obviously living it on a day-by-day basis, but certainly a number of podcasts that I listened to, sports-related podcasts from abroad, people were, although often lamenting, the lack of supporters in the venues. I mean, when they're watching them on TV, obviously it doesn't always, it doesn't always affect the viewing experience, of course. So I don't know. Was there a sense while you were experiencing it that it was an important event that the world needed? Because I think that's what a lot of people were saying. Either podcasters from Australia or from America or from the UK, is that these were still the best athletes in their chosen sports, competing at the highest level. And after what we've all been through in the past couple of years, it was just great, I think, for so many people to just celebrate sport. And while you were there, the lack of crowds was obviously something that you couldn't fail to notice. But the overall experience of, as I said, covering the best athletes in the world, especially when you got summoned over to the track and field on one magical night, didn't you? I mean, it must have just been a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, I think that I'll touch on a couple points that you brought up, and as you say, it was an opportunity to focus on the athletes and to focus on sport. And I think that these Olympics were very unique in that they gave us that opportunity. Normally, it's the festival, it's the fanfare, it's the spectacle, it's the crowds, it's the super fans. It is all of the events that are happening in the periphery of the Olympics. Like, there, all of that was sort of shoved to the side. And I think that because of these circumstances and being held behind closed doors, it was just the viewers watching the athletes, and the cameras had nowhere else to really pan over to. And in that sense, I wrote for our sort of post-games wrap-up that it was the athletes' Olympics. It was the first time that we could really, like, it's in a way like when you're having dinner with your family and you decide that it's going to be no cell phones at the dinner table. It was sort of that for sports.
Mm-hmm.
All of the noise was sort of lowered, not necessarily cut out, but lowered. And we got to see the athletes do amazing things, and we got a chance to let them sort of tell the story just because of how much they use social media to share their experience in the village and at the venues and competing. So I think we've mentioned the track and field thing a couple of times. Long story short, I got the chance to interview Sebastian Coe, who is the head of World Athletics. And so I got to go to the National Stadium on the first Saturday, which included the women's 100 final. Mm-hmm. So I got to see the Jamaican sprinters claim the entire podium. That was cool. And you get there, and there is the little sports square near the JOC, the Japan Olympic Museum. And there's, like, the five-ring statue, and there's hundreds of people just hanging around taking photos, fans trying to trade pins with the media who were going in. It was a bit of a scene, and it was nice to see that. It was a bit of normalcy. And, to be there in that stadium, I think we have our opinions of it as a football venue, but as a track venue, pretty damn cool. And again, with fans, it would have been incredible. But to see it and to see all the journalists there, I was three or four rows above, I think, the Jamaican Football Federation's media team. And to see them celebrating after that final, it was just really cool. And, it was an unbelievable experience, if only because it came together in over the course of an afternoon. I was summoned at maybe 1 o'clock, and I was there at 4. And yeah, it was just sort of my crazy, unique story of the Olympics, and I'll always have that.
Despite kind of all the challenges that Tokyo 2020 faced, do you think they were able to create kind of a positive, lasting legacy with what they managed to put on?
I have no idea what the legacy of Tokyo 2020 is. It was a great sporting event. Was it a great Olympics? I mean, that depends on how you define a great Olympics. I think that the legacy of Tokyo 2020, it's going to take a while for everyone to figure out exactly what it was all about and what it meant. And I'll plug something. There was a very fascinating website called olympicanalysis.org, and they recruited just about 100 different writers to write about different aspects of the Olympics and what it all meant. And I've been reading some of the stories here and there. It's fascinating. So that's just a plug. I didn't write for it. Wasn't paid to endorse it, but it's a cool tableau of a bunch of different perspectives on Tokyo 2020 for people who might be interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, so just before we move on to a quick chat about the Paralympics, you mentioned the pins there, Dan, and regular listeners know that you are quite the collector, mainly of football scarves, and recently you've moved on to a crew quite a decent kit collection, haven't you? So I'm sure you were an ardent pin hunter yourself. You ended up with quite a haul, I imagine.
I hunted a bit at the Paralympics. So lapel pin trading is one of those cool traditions of the Olympics, and normally what would happen is that you'd have all the sponsors giving out pins, and there were, I think, Coca-Cola had various things throughout the last couple of years, and you'd get the pins from all them, but then you'd trade with other fans, and all of the teams that are competing at the Olympics, they all have their own custom pins, or a lot of them do, and they give them to volunteers and to media and to broadcasters, and so trading them and building a collection is one of those cool things. I did get a couple cool trades. I bought a few Paralympic pins, and I did some trading with some volunteers and that sort of thing. So hopefully I can build on it. That was a cool little thing to do. Any future Olympics I cover, I'll make sure to go in well stocked and see what I can get out of it.
Yeah, nice one. And of course, we could mention the SEX beds guy. I must admit, a story that I had no idea at all about until I saw your link to your article, which I then read and found fascinating. But I guess I just wasn't spending enough time on Twitter in the lead up to the Olympics, and then once they got going, because I was basically only watching skateboarding under orders of my two kids. So we can park that and move on to another of your pet projects. I would say it's safe to say, Dan. Obviously, the Wii League was one. You've covered it extensively in its lead up, and the other is blind soccer, the Japanese national blind soccer team that you've given an awful lot of precious column inches to, and I'm sure all the people involved with that group are very thankful to you for that. So yeah, what was it like to see a team that you followed for quite a while now, ply their trade on the biggest stage, on the Olympic stage, and come close to a medal?
It was very cool to see the blind Japan's national team in action, and I think the coolest part about this Olympics, these Paralympics, I should say, was that not only was it Japan's first time playing in the blind football competition at the Paralympics, but it was their first time wearing the national team uniform, the JFA and the JBFA, the Japan Blind Football Association, worked together on a sort of a team football Japan, I believe that was the name of the initiative. And so all three teams, the men, the women, and the blind team, wore the same kit. And that's just really cool. And it does show that, you know, the JFA and Adidas are very, you know, good about promoting inclusive football here. And, you know, that was just awesome to see. The game I saw wasn't so great because they did lose to Brazil quite thoroughly. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch further games because I was doing photography at the Paralympics because I had strained my hip quite badly the previous day and decided after that game that I should take it easy and watch the home end of the Paralympics from a desk with lots of ice. You know, that was a cool experience. The urban Almi blind football venue was really cool setup. And again, would have been amazing with fans. Maybe not so much that game against Brazil because I think the temperatures were in the 30s and there was just no clouds in the sky, just all sun. But that was cool. And the whole Paralympics were cool. Just so many amazing athletes, so many cool sports. You really had to see it to believe it.
What other sports did you get to cover? Is there anything you could recommend to for someone who didn't get to see enough of the Paralympics?
I mean, I think the ones that I fell for, I mean, the track was cool. You know, seeing blind long distance long jumpers, the wheelchair racers, you know, the blind runners are really cool because like it's not just the runner, it's the guide. So they have to run together with their guide, and that's like an incredibly hard thing to do because they're holding a tether, they're attached at the hip practically. And you think about that over a distance of 100 or 200 meters, but then a marathon. Mm. It's just amazing. But I think the sports, what else did I say? I saw powerlifting, which isn't the most sort of spectator-friendly sport, but still amazing to see these, you know, these lifters lifting twice, three times their weight. It's incredible. Wheelchair fencing was incredibly cool, and the venue was awesome. Goalball was neat. Again, maybe, you know, I guess depending on who's playing, you can sort of debate how TV friendly it is. But the two coolest sports, undoubtedly, wheelchair basketball, wheelchair rugby.
Yeah.
Murder ball.
Yeah,
geez. It was amazing.
Not for the faint hearted.
No. And it was really interesting because I shot Japan's group stage game against Denmark and then the bronze game against Australia. And I watched a couple of the other games on TV, but like you see how different some of these teams are tactically and how like the gold game between Team GB and Team USA, like really physical, like that's a brutal sport and so cool. Just incredible athleticism. And the tactics that go into it, you've got coaches who are making substitutions with 3 seconds left in the quarter. You know, just a lot of thought goes into it, and it was just fascinating to watch as a first-timer.
Yeah, brilliant. What a wonderful experience, as we've said, and I hope that's come through for the listeners in the past, you know, 20 minutes or so. Yeah, absolutely terrific, Dan. And you've just about recovered from all that, and obviously still on J League duty as well. And then along comes the long awaited launch of the We League on Sunday. I have to hold my hands up here and say that on J Talk we haven't given basically any time at all to the competition in its lead up. But here we are. The first round of games were played on Sunday. The league consists of 11 teams, so in each round there'll be 5 games, and their one team will have a We Action Day in this match week 1. Dan, that was Jeff United Ichihara Chiba Ladies who had the We Action Day. So, right off the top, what does that involve? I presume some community based activities to get young girls interested in the game.
Basically, it was they only officially called decided to call it We Action, or they announced that they were calling it We Action Day on Friday or Saturday. So the branding is a bit new. But yes, it's the idea is that it's not a bye week. It is a chance for clubs to do community service in a way, but basically to promote the vision and the ideals and the things that the league believes in, which are, of course, gender equality, promoting just the creation of a society in which women can excel, whether that's on the pitch or in the workplace. And so it is, in a way, up to the clubs to figure out what they're doing. I believe that Jeff did they held a YouTube forum of some sort, and I think that the club is also running a food drive over the course of this week. So you'll have to see it. The league from the start has been very forward about its social goals and what it wants to accomplish, not just on the pitch, but off the pitch. If you saw, they had their press conference to promote the league on Monday, or I should say the Monday before everything started on the 6th. And the final video teaser that they showed was the chairperson, Kikuko Okajima, and three players kicking a ball through glass plates. Not quite glass ceilings, but, you know, the glass sort of barrier. Mm-hmm. And the shards of those glass plates are going to be turned into the trophy. Wow. So it's all about breaking down barriers. And yes, it is on the nose. The league's name stands for Women Empowerment League. Like, we can crack wise about how this isn't really subtle. And yes, maybe they could have gone with a bit more subtlety in their messaging, but I think that you sort of have to be unsubtle about this, especially in Japan, where awareness of issues like this, you know, it isn't as common as it is in Australia, in the US, in Europe. So it is a big step, and hopefully, you know, we saw a lot of great play yesterday on Sunday. So, you know, the sky's the limit if this league can really get going.
Yeah, it sounds like they've done a lot of good work in the build-up to this. And how has that met in terms of attendances over the weekend? Obviously, it's difficult during a pandemic to get a real gauge on anything, but did they meet the expectations?
I think given the fact that we are still in a state of emergency, I think that the league should be happy with the attendances. None of the games got the lowest attendance was just under 1,400 at Chifre ASL in Saitama's game against Sanfrecce Hiroshima Regina, and that's pretty good. I think Kumagaya is not an easy place to get to. The Ainak Kobe and Omiya Ardija game got over 4,000 with a 10 a.m. kickoff.
Right.
Which, amazing accomplishment. Yeah. Now, Ainak have, one of the biggest consistent fandoms in the league right now. I think that Urawa will probably match them once they get their home games going next week. But 10 a.m., and that kickoff time was so that they could get airtime on local TV, which is important for exposure. But it's a 10 a.m. kickoff, but still they got the biggest attendance of the round. Tokyo and Urawa pulled in over 2,400. These are good numbers, but the challenge is going to be keeping them up once the state of emergency ends, raising them, keeping them consistent over the season. It's not going to be easy. But if the football is there, if families come out to games and keep coming out to games, then there's a lot of potential.
Yes, indeed. And before we go any further on the Wii League, Sam, I should just inform you that, for the record, Jeff United Ichihara Chiba Ladies are the official team of the J-Talk podcast. Of course, a friend of the podcast, Ami Otaki, is playing for them, wearing the number 9 kit. So, we can't wait to see Ami in action in match week 2 when...
No, you'll see her next season.
Oh, why? What's happened?
She... She's pregnant. She's on maternity leave.
Oh, right. I did see something about that on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. Yes, no, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, let's not cut this, but like the fact that she is on, you know, that she is taking time off to have, you know, her child, and when she announced that, she also announced that she had gotten married. So, you know, congrats. It is about things like promoting the ability of players to have kids and still be pros. You know, that's sort of unthinkable in the old era, in the pre-Wii League era. So, you know, it does represent how forward-thinking certainly officials and clubs want the league to be.
Yeah, well,
that's great, legend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Congratulations
on all that, Ami, and thanks for filling us in, Dan. Yeah, I must admit, I did see that, a couple of tweets from Ami that, she was pregnant a couple of weeks ago, and then it just completely different. It didn't click with me until, you've just mentioned that, because I clicked onto the Chiba team website thinking that, she might be playing for them, and there she is, with a squad photo and the number 9 kit. But yes, of course, she can't play if she's due to have a baby. So, all the best with all that. But it goes without saying, Sam, that we'll still stick with Chiba all the way until Ami makes her debut, and then for as long as she's with them. So, Dan, the long-awaited, as we said, debut of this competition. We don't want to sugarcoat everything, though. There were certainly some, obviously some teething problems in getting everything up and running, and that's partly due to the pandemic, as we all know. But then on Sunday, there were some complaints from some people at a lack of access on YouTube when it was assumed that all games were going to be streamed around the world and not be geo-blocked. But, some people who were keen on checking out some of these games on the opening match week were unable to for certain reasons that I'm sure you can fill us in on.
Yeah, so my understanding, and I've talked to league officials regarding this, is that they expected all the games to be unblocked for overseas fans. So this does appear to be an issue with however DAZN handled their YouTube page. They did pick two games that weren't geo-blocked. I think one was the Chifre game, and the other was Albirex Niigata and Nagano Parcero. That is a start. To the Wii League's credit, all of the highlights that they've hosted so far are open to the world, so you can go and check those out. I think this was just sort of some round one teething pains, and hopefully heading into round two and beyond, things are a bit smoother in terms of not just the geo-blocking issue in general, but also alerting fans as to which games will be available, which I don't think they were able to do for the first round. And again, new league, something's going to go wrong. So, I'm not going to harp on them too much, but I think that league officials are aware that this was a bit of an own goal, and they're working to prevent that going forward.
Just in terms of kind of the product on the pitch, what is the goal of the Wii League? Is it want to bring in superstar foreign names? Is that one of the aims of the league, to kind of build it in that way, or is the focus more on like getting good homegrown talent coming through?
I think that the focus is to create better homegrown talent. This league was conceived in response to the evolving situation with women's football worldwide, where you have leagues across the world that are going professional, where the parent clubs are investing millions of dollars into their women's teams where they didn't do that before. And you definitely have the top talent in the world who are collecting in the United States, in Britain with the Super League, in Germany and France and Spain and Italy. And I think that Japan has in a way coasted on its reputation for player development over this last decade, ever since the Women's World Cup title in 2011. And As Okajima said, I don't think the quality of women's football in Japan has gone down. So the quality of women's football in the rest of the world has gone up. So the question is, how do you fix that? Well, one of the solutions is you go pro, you make it so that players can focus on playing so they don't have to support themselves with second and third jobs, so that they have the resources and the facilities and the staffing that they need to improve. And they're also working on bringing in foreign players who can help the Japanese players develop by being the kind of opponents who they can expect to play at a Women's World Cup, at the Olympics, at the Asian Cup, when they go overseas. So in a way, a lot of that mirrors what the J-League was in 93, although it isn't fair to compare the two. You can argue that Japan needed a women's league a decade ago, but of course, I don't think Japan was quite ready then, and I don't think the rest of the world was quite ready then. So that's sort of where we're at.
Yeah, fair enough. Then I tell you what, I wish they'd do something about the length of some of these team names, but they hardly roll off the tongue, do they? Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, Urawa Reds Ladies, and we already mentioned Jeff United, Ishihara Chiba Ladies.
But I will tell you, the Wii League data site shortens it to MHI Urawa Reds Ladies, so I am declaring that canon. As far as English language writing is concerned, and I encourage anyone writing about the team in English to follow me. And I'll be fair. Normally when you're writing in a journalistic capacity, whether you're a newspaper or a wire service, you usually don't include the team's title sponsor when you're writing. Like, that's just sort of a style thing. But I think that there is a need for some compromise here, especially because you have My Navi Sendai, where, when the title sponsor is the name of the team because they own the team, it is sort of unfair to write My Navi Sendai and not write MHI or Our Reds. So that's a challenge, and this is maybe a bit too inside baseball for anyone who isn't a writer. But there you go.
Yeah, fair enough. Then all right. So thanks, Dan. Really interesting first match week in the Wii League then, and it continues on this coming weekend. Obviously we'll cover the results from time to time as the inaugural season progresses. And we can't let you go though without mentioning, of course, the return of Yuto Nagatomo to FC Tokyo. It was announced by the club on Sunday. It happened to be the occasion of Yuto's 35th birthday as well. So he returns to the club after a lengthy stint in Europe, in Italy, Turkey, and then France. And he was in attendance at Ajinomoto Stadium for FC Tokyo's first home game since the end of June, which coincidentally was your last appearance on J-Talk, Dan, of course, before the Olympics got up and running. But unfortunately for Yuto, for you and me, Dan, and all other FC Tokyo supporters, the team laid an egg on their return to Ajinomoto Stadium. An early Mao Hosoya goal won the game for Kashiwa Reysol 1-0 over Tokyo. So we certainly don't need to spend too much time on this game because the Tokyo were fairly ordinary in it, but the return of Yuto Nagatomo to the J-League and also the return of Yoshinori Muto as well, but in his case he's ventured over to Kobe. Did Tokyo get the right returnee back to the club, or would you have preferred to see maybe Muto come back and Nagatomo go elsewhere?
Yeah, I'd have liked to see them both come back. I do think that it's really hard to see. Yeah, I guess in terms of depth, maybe they decided that now was the time to bring Yuto back, and the fact that he has been without a club, and I think we did see the effect of that in the Japan-Oman game. It does feel in a cynical way like this is sort of a signing that is more meant to keep the Tokyo fan base motivated. I don't know if you agree with that or not, Ben.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from there. Yeah.
You know, and there was a story, it was by Etsuko Motokawa, who is one of the best football columnists in Japan, and she did a thing on how Kanto area clubs, especially those whose venues or whose home stadiums were used for the Olympics, were really struggling. And so she talked to the marketing people at FC Tokyo, at Yokohama F. Marinos, at Urawa Reds. And, like, Tokyo are in a really difficult position. It's hard to underscore just how well the club was doing in 2019 when average attendance broke the 30,000 mark for the first time ever. I believe they were, the third club to do that after Niigata and Urawa? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sounds right.
The marketing was there. They had the new deal with, I guess they didn't have the deal with New Balance yet, but, you know, everything was falling into place for FC Tokyo. And then the pandemic hit. And, you know, everyone survived the 2020 season. But as every club president, as every league official said, it wasn't just about surviving 2020. It was about surviving 2021. And what we're seeing is that, you know, average attendance this season is about as low, if not even a bit lower than it was last season, because we've basically been stuck in a state of emergency. By the time we get to the end of September, I think Tokyo will have been in a state of emergency for something like 220 out of about 280 days of the year. So, you know, you can sell merch, you can cut costs, but in the end, if fans aren't coming to the stadium, not only are you not getting that ticketing revenue, not only are you getting day-of sales, not only are you not getting, you know, all the sponsorships and activation events that you normally get, but the biggest concern that Tokyo and other clubs have is that if the casual fans aren't going to games, then what's going to get them to start going again? And that's not just a Tokyo problem. That's an everyone problem, because you can easily sell 5,000 tickets to core supporters, to season ticket holders, to regulars, to, you know, to people who are established J-League fans. But the clubs need to grow, and you can't grow without new fans. And right now, in year two of, you know, the pandemic, they can't get to them, and they may not be able to get to them until next season. Knock on wood, it's next season. So in that sense, I think that this is a signing that at least reminds the casual fans, reminds the hardcore fans who, you know, haven't had the greatest of times this season, that, you know, it's the Tokyo that they remember. Because I think we all remember that FC Tokyo of 2008-2009. And hopefully that sort of inspires a bit of goodwill towards the club in a time when it really needs it.
Yeah, from the outside, Sam, what did you think of the Nagatomo signing for Tokyo? Does it smack as a retirement tour for you, or do you still think that Nagatomo will have something to offer Tokyo, not only for obviously the rest of this season, but in a year or two to come as well? Obviously, there is a need for reinforcement at fullback. Ryoya Ogawa is certainly not everybody's cup of tea, and while we do have high hopes for Kashif Bangunagunde, he's far from the finished article. So, how do you think Nagatomo will affect things at Tokyo? As I said, not only this year, but maybe in a year or two's time.
Well, he'll still definitely have something to offer. He'll go in as Tokyo's best fullback at the moment, and you'll get another good year or two out of him, I'd say. But I think it's not quite a signing like Osaka or Muto, who are still there or thereabouts in their prime and are still kind of at the top of their game. I mean, Nagatomo at Marseille was phased out towards the end of last season, and he's definitely on the wane, but you bring him in there, he's got such vast experience, he will help those young players, he'll maybe get Ogawa to a better level and definitely help Kashifu Bangonagande. So it's a really good... I think it was an important signing for Tokyo. Yeah, a morale boost as well, as one thing, but definitely I think he still improves that team. And I don't think Tokyo could really have passed up on the opportunity of getting Nagatomo when he became available. So I think it's a good move all round. And yeah, it's kind of a... I don't know whether maybe you two could answer this. Do you think Tokyo were kind of compelled to sign a player like Nagatomo, given that other teams like have signed Osako, Muto, Inoue, Sakai have all come back into the league? Do they feel like they needed to make that sort of signing as well?
I think personally, I mean, I was at that game. I think, Ben, you may have been at that game too when he left for Cesena.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he stood in front of that mic and he put on those sunglasses and he said that, you know, he was going to go out and conquer the world, but come back home. And when he, you know, when he knocks on your door, yeah, you can't say no. And there were certainly reports out there that I think Vissel Kobe had offered him twice as much as Tokyo ended up offering him. But the fact that he took Tokyo's offer, that he wants to come back, it does speak to his relationship with the club and the level of attachment that he has. Because I think that even though he only played at Tokyo for 2.5 seasons, he was ours. He was the first player that FC Tokyo sent overseas. That was a big deal at the time. It was a huge summer for Tokyo because you had Nagatomo and Kono representing FC Tokyo at the World Cup in South Africa, and then for Nagatomo to go to Italy, playing, you know, in one of the big four, and the fact that he went over, you know, to Inter and had such a great career, you know, he is one of the most important players in FC Tokyo history. So I think we have, over the years, you know, we've talked about the farewell ceremony and how it was always players saying, oh, I'm going to go out and become stronger and be a big deal, but then I'm going to come back home. And it always feels disappointing because we always feel like those players never lived up to their potential. Kakitani, Yamaguchi, Kiyotake to some extent. Well, Kiyotake did pretty well. You know, I mean, a lot of the Setoso players, a lot of J-leaguers, really, you know, Gen Shoji, we can go on and on and on. But Nagatomo did it. He went, for him as a Japanese defender, to go to one of the most defensive, crazy countries in the world, and to become just a regular at Inter and such a reliable presence there, it does speak volumes to the kind of player he was and the kind of player he can hopefully still be for another season or two. So I think that this is a homecoming that you can look at it and say, you know, it's time. He deserves it. He's going to be treated like a king at Tokyo for however long he keeps playing, and it's absolutely earned.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, I'll echo all that. And as Dan said right back at the start when we started talking about Nagatomo, I think there was an element of, yeah, throwing a bone to the supporters, but also the you know, the overall fact is that Nagatomo wanted to come back to Tokyo, and that's something, yeah, that we couldn't pass up. Yeah, certainly one of the most beloved players from Tokyo in my time supporting the team. Yeah, as you said earlier, Dan, it would have been great to bring Muto back as well. Certainly the most electrifying attacker, domestic attacker that Tokyo have had since Naohiro Ishikawa's 2009 epic season. But yeah, as it turned out, Nagatomo is returning, and yeah, I'm sure we'll see him in action maybe as soon as this weekend, because yeah, Tokyo can could certainly need use all the help they can get at this stage. Dan, so just before we let you go, there was one other thing that we wanted to mention. We talked about briefly in the green room. You've had some obviously some massive events going on this year. Obviously, they don't come much bigger than the Olympics and the Paralympics. Then, covering the launch of the Wii League on Sunday. But it appears that one thing you won't have to cover domestically this year is the Club World Cup.
Yes, Ben, that's right. So the Japan Football Association announced the other day that due to the pandemic, due to what they expect to be continued limits on crowds and possibly immigration restrictions, that they're giving up their right to host the Club World Cup, which is a bummer. It would have been cool to see that competition back here, and hopefully we get a chance to make it up at some point, but the end result is no Club World Cup in Japan, and they have also shifted the Emperor's Cup final to December 19th, which was supposed to be the date of the Club World Cup final. So not only will there be no Club World Cup, but no New Year's Day Emperor's Cup final, which will be good in for two reasons. I mean, one is that it'll give everyone who usually has to spend their New Year's holiday dealing with the Emperor's Cup some well-deserved time off, especially in these times. And, of course, we have to remember that the J-League season is going to start earlier than ever next year because of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. So they have to start that early and wrap it up pretty early.
Sam, I know you, for one, are certainly not opposed to the Emperor's Cup final date being moved forward.
Absolutely not. It's the worst day of my year every year. Because, New Year's Day, I have to start work at 3 a.m, which isn't great after a long night on New Year's Eve. So, and it always goes to extra time as well. So, I'm not unhappy that this has been moved. And, it does allow some space to bring the league forward next season. It's going to be another grind trying to get in between February and, I'd say, would it be the end of October they'd have to try and finish it?
End of October, early November. I think that there have been dates floated. I don't know exactly what they are offhand, but yeah, I think we're in for another really early start. The Super Cup could be on February 5th or maybe even January 29th if they want to push it up that early. But I mean, we could see the league start on February 12th, it looks like.
Well, you never know, Sam. If you're lucky, they might put the Super Cup on New Year's Day instead of the Emperor's Cup final. So that would be even better for you.
Oh, no. And then they have that penalty shootout Yokohama and Kobe had that went on for years.
Oh, geez. Well, we'll wait and see. Obviously, a lot for the JFA and the J-League to sort out in the months to come. But, Dan, it's been absolutely brilliant to catch up with you and, just get an overall sense of what the Olympics and Paralympics was like for you. And, with the Wii League starting as well, as I said, the timing was absolutely perfect. So, we certainly don't have to worry about FC Tokyo causing any damage in the ACL race towards the end of the season. So we won't need to send out the bat signal, I think, for any rampant Tokyo run that sees them surge up the table. But we will catch up with you, I'm sure, before the end of this season with what looks like an epic sort of title race shaping up. So, for now, as I said, terrific to catch up with you, and we look forward to doing so again soon.
Absolutely, gents. Always a pleasure. And I guess soon we have to start planning J-Talk After Dark, because congratulations on hitting $200-something dollars a month on Patreon. That's a huge thing for you.
Thank you very much, mate. Yes, a certain milestone that you'd pegged fairly early doors, and there we've managed to reach with a lot of help from a lot of great people over the course of our time on Patreon. So, very much appreciate that. And yes, the research and development department are already hard at work to putting the groundwork down on the After Dark podcast. So our people will be calling your people. No worries about that. Thank you, Dan. So after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be back to round up all of the J1 Match Day 28 action. Yosh! All right, welcome back. A huge thank you to Dan for all of that in part one. Let's turn our attention to J1 Match Day 28, played over 3 days this past weekend, with a reminder that there were only 9 games played because Kawasaki versus Kobe will be held on Wednesday the 29th, in between Match Days 30 and 31, and that the Wednesday before that, Kawasaki and the other J1 teams in the round of 16 of the ACL, Nagoya and Cerezo Osaka, will play their Match Day 32 fixtures. All of that means that before the end of September, Frontale have 4 league games to play, and Yokohama F. Marinos have their regularly scheduled 2. So Kawasaki are going to have to fight off fatigue and bank some wins if they're going to remain on top, as F. Marinos certainly aren't going away. The latest example of that, Sam, came down in Hiroshima on Saturday evening, where the visitors fell behind in just the 8th minute to a Douglas Vieira goal, but after a Daisen Maeda redirected Marcos Junior's shot past a wrong-footed Keisuke Osako to equalise in the 36th minute, F. Marinos really started to express themselves.
They did. I was wondering after the blip against Kashima what the response would be, and they had a couple of defensive injuries as well, but and went down 1-0. But yeah, as you said, the response was very good. Maybe a little bit of fortune about the equalising goal, but from then on, yeah, they became the usual F. Marinos. They went forward, they caused so many problems for Hiroshima, and to be fair to Hiroshima, they didn't give in the game. They gave as good as they got to in the end of the second half, but Marinos, despite being without Thiago Martins and Hatanaka, they defended pretty well and ground out a very important 3 points, and yeah, it's great for them to get back to winning ways and yeah, not let Kawasaki off the hook.
Most definitely. So, yeah, one of the members of that makeshift back line, centre-back Yuki Sanato, scored a remarkable overhead back flick in first-half stoppage time to give F. Marinos the lead. And then on the hour, Leo Ciara blasted in a stunning free kick from 30 yards. A real goal of the season contender, although we'll check with Sam later whether he thought Eduardo's in the Tosu game was better, to give them a two-goal cushion, which they did need, Sam. As you said, Sanfrecce certainly didn't throw in the towel here. And in the last 20 minutes, Yoshifumi Kashiwa volleyed straight at Yohei Takaoka. And then the veteran midfielder, Toshihiro Aoyama, smashed a shot against the bar. Although certainly you could call Yoshifumi Kashiwa a veteran midfielder as well. But yeah, so the 3-1 win away from home sees F. Marinos close to within a point of the leaders and defending champions. They were tested early and then, as we've just mentioned, late on. But overall, Kevin Muscat can be very satisfied with the terrific evening's work away from home.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought they were in their stride for most of this game. They were in control for most of it. They looked, yeah, they looked up at it. Then, I mean, they're getting the best out of Leo Ciara as well. Ever since, I think I was asked the question, was he that good a striker? And I've pretty much said no, and he's gone on a wonderful goal-scoring run after that, which is just typical. But, yeah, it was a terrific effort from him, a superb strike from that free kick. And just, yeah, in general play, they looked very on it. They didn't look like they were fazed by going 1-0 down. And yeah, it was a very clinical performance from Marinos.
Before we leave this game, Sam, Graham Freche was back with a couple more questions. Of course, one of our regular contributors, one of our patrons as well. He's wondering about who might end up as the Golden Boot winner in J1, Sam. Graham Freche says that Daisen Maeda isn't really the typical goal-scoring forward. Leandro Damião of Kawasaki should have won it after Furuhashi left. But, yeah, Damião hasn't scored that many lately. Graham Freche asks if you think that Daisen Maeda will win it, or is there a chance for somebody like Leo Ciara or perhaps even Shimizu's Thiago Santana to make a come-from-behind effort and snatch the Golden Boot in the last 10 games?
Well, it's a very open race at the moment. I mean, Furuhashi was running away with it, wasn't he, at the start of the season? So it's definitely come together. I don't know. Damião, I think he's probably the best out-and-out striker that is in the league. And he'd probably still just about be favourite, although you'd expect him to be rotated a little bit more given Frontale's fixture congestion than Maeda, and Marinos do create so many chances. So, I mean, I'm glad it's not Anderson Lopez, so my hat is safe and I don't have to eat that. But otherwise, yeah, I think Maeda would probably be my favourite. He gets into such good positions and is there to finish off chances, and Marinos are going to score two or three goals in most games. Leo Sierra, I still have my reservations about him. I mean, he just got that terrific free kick. And Thiago Santana, I really like him as a striker, but he's playing for Shimizu at the moment, who don't go forward too often. He has to do a lot on his own, so I think he has his work cut out. So I would be siding at the moment with Dyson Maeda as top goal scorer, but there's a good three or four up there that could take it. So that's another interesting race we've got at the end of this season.
Yeah, most definitely. So, yeah, Maeda did join Furuhashi at the top of the charts with his 15th goal, this equaliser at Hiroshima on Saturday. And, Damiao one goal back of that pair. Of course, Furuhashi won't be adding to his tally. So, I guess, yeah, to the casual observer, it does look like a race in two. But if Leo Sierra really hits his straps, maybe in an Eric-style burst late on in the season, mm-hmm. as F. Marino's really peak at the climax of the season, then yeah, he could possibly make a late run out there up the outside. But for me, it does look a race in two at the moment. Thanks for that to Grant Fritche, and we have more questions to come from him throughout this J1 wrap up. Next to the battle for third spot. And with incumbents Kobe, of course, inactive this weekend, Tosu and Nagoya took advantage and climbed back above Vissel. Sagan winning 2-1 at home over Shimizu, thanks to the previously mentioned Eduardo's superb 74th-minute free kick. I'm not sure how many other adjectives Sam would like to tack on to superb, but it was absolutely brilliant. And, for the second straight league game, the Brazilians' free kick magistry was on full display. For Grampus, they ultimately cruised to a 3-0 win at home over Tokushima on Friday night football, but the visitors were done in. Is it too harsh to say that the visitors were done in by a pretty ordinary refereeing performance from Yuichi Nishimura? There was a very harsh-looking penalty decision and straight red card for Takeru Kishimoto 5 minutes into the second half. That came at 0-0. Mateus scored from the spot, and Grampus were away, although it did take them until the last 10 minutes to wrap up the points, and both of their second and third goals, rather, came in fortuitous circumstances. Joel Fujita headed superbly into his own net, and then Mu Kanazaki scored at Nagoya's second penalty of the evening, again a decision that looked fairly harsh after the defender won the ball first. So, Grampus obviously won't be complaining, Sam. That's a 3-0 win for them, and an amazing stat that Mitch Langerak in his defence have already broken the clean sheet record that they set last year. It's 18 clean sheets in 28 games. We were all blown away by the fact they did 17 last year in 34, so their ratio this season is, to say it's off the charts, it's unprecedented. Especially when you consider Yuichi Maruyama's been out injured for so long, it's just a testament to Langerak and the way he organises his defence and the personnel that they have in the back four, even when they're forced to rotate due to injury, Sam. So, yeah, these two games together then, Sagan winning in more difficult circumstances, both of these teams winning in obviously different ways, but they didn't blink when the chance to move back above Kobe presented itself.
No, both teams are in pretty decent form at the moment, and Sagan, despite everything that seems to be going against them off the field, they still have answers on the pitch. I mean, that first 11 is still very good. I mean, Shirasaki and Koizumi have come in the transfer window. Shirasaki got the first goal, and then, yeah, Eduardo's free kick. I got it as a howitzer, is what I've written down here. It was a terrific strike. And, you know, I'm not biased at all, but Eduardo takes it for me over Leo Sierra. Just that little clip off the bar, I think, adds a little bit to it. It's unbelievable strike. And, yeah, fair play to Tosu moving up into third. And then Nagoya, yeah. And I thought Tokushima were very hard done to by the refereeing decisions. But Nagoya were much the better team even before that first referee decision went against them. Obviously, when you go down to 10 men and a goal down, it's pretty much game over anyway, especially against Ficadente's side with such a good defensive record, as you mentioned there. And yeah, so they didn't really have much chance to come back, Tokushima, but Nagoya were the better side. And yeah, they deserved the 3 points, even though I thought Kishimoto was hard done to. He barely touched Naoki Maeda when Maeda went through, and then to get the red card as well in that situation is very harsh. And then Kaka, I mean, it was clumsy defending because he clears it away from Sommer with his standing foot accidentally before kind of swinging through with his the following right foot. So yeah, it was clumsy defending, but I still think he got the ball and cleared it away. So another, yeah, fortunate one for Nagoya, but on the even before the red card, they were the better side, so yeah, deserve that. They're in really good form, and they go up against Yokohama next weekend in what's looking to be a really interesting match.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, spoiler alert, I think that's going to be your pick of the match day 29 fixtures, isn't it? And do not blame you at all. But yeah, so after those wins, Tosu and Nagoya both have 50 points. Then joining Kobe on 48 are Urawa, who won 2-0 at Yokohama FC in Sam's pick of the match day 28 fixture list. And from the highlights, Sam, it looked like a decent shout from you. Yokohama FC, obviously, we've mentioned in fairly positive terms since the Olympic break. Both in the terms of the splashes they've made in the transfer window, but and also an uptick in their performances. It did look an interesting game, this. But, Reds ultimately ran out to 2-0 winners thanks to a header from a totally unmarked Koya Yuruki just past the half hour, and a late sealer from Tomoaki Okubo on the counter. Yuruki's goal was his first of the season, and Okubo's his first in J1. While the big losers in the hunt for third this week, in more ways than one, were Kashima, who plummeted from fourth to seventh after a stunning 3-0 home defeat at the hands of Fukuoka. Avispa blew a chance to take the lead inside the first 20 minutes when Yuya Yamagishi's penalty was tipped onto the post by Antlers keeper Yuya Oki, who made amends for upending Wanma and giving away the spot kick. But the big Spaniard fired Fukuoka ahead shortly after when he finished off a lovely team move with a crisp first-time finish and bagged a first-half brace when he turned in a pinpoint Masato Yuzawa cross 4 minutes before the break. Yamagishi did finally beat Oki when he sent the Fukuoka faithful into dreamland with his 64th minute header. And though Masaaki Murakami was kept busy in the Avispa net in the last 20 minutes, his defence stood firm as they did the double over Antlers, a famous victory that moved them up to eighth. With all that said, though, I think Graham Freche's question is straight to the point and very apt here, Sam. On Kashima, what the hell happened there on Saturday?
That's a terrific question. I think they'll be asking the same one of themselves. And they were absolutely awful, but in full credit to Avispa, who were completely on it from the first minute. They pressed so high, they were really aggressive. They saw that Kashima had a real weakness at centre back, with Inokai is out injured, Machida was out injured, so they played Hayashi and Bueno. And Bueno, I mean, he's been in and around the league a couple of times. He's just come back from a spell in Brazil. He is dreadful. And they played on him. They got the ball into the area quickly. It was a much more, like, Avispa have been quite direct in the way they're playing, quite like defence first, but this was a lot more proactive. They were right in on them. They gave them no time to breathe. And Wanma, goodness me, what a performance this was. And I don't think I ever thought I would say that, but it looked a complete striker in it. We worked the channels, which is how he got the penalty early on. He was his movement in the area to make space, and then his finishing, it was all absolutely superb. And I don't know what Kashima are doing, because yes, they've lost two centre-backs, but there's a good team there. You've just beaten Yokohama, but their midfield, which I was praising so much a couple of weeks ago, was non-existent. The full-backs, Koke Anzai has come back. He's played right and left back. And you think Japan International, he's played in Europe, you expect a lot more from him, but he got completely done by Kanemori and Yuzawa down the right side. And young Sunamoto had a difficult game as well, so... Yeah, Antlers just did not turn up, but a lot of it was the way that Avispa approached the game. So positive, and a 3-0 win honestly didn't flatter them, because Kashima didn't start playing until they were 3-0 down.
All right, well, yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And, while we're focusing on the race for third here, we want to make sure we give Fukuoka their proper due, because that is an absolutely brilliant result, and in a season where they've just continued to defy expectations, and absolutely superb performance so far for Hasebe's team, and they sit eighth in the table, which will please the Fukuoka massive, in particular Daniel, who is engaged in a little bit of a friendly running battle with Thomas in the Patreon only line group for now. Daniel does have the bragging rights with the Fukuoka goal difference above FC Tokyo, and over their performance throughout the season, even though the teams have identical records, Tokyo supporters can't have any complaints at all when Fukuoka are winning games like that in such style. So, absolutely terrific from Avispa. For Antlers, though, Sam, I don't know, is it back to the drawing board again? It's one step forward, two steps back. They'd come in on the back of two straight wins. We thought they were, primed for this push for third. And again, they're only 3 points behind. So, and they do have still have the best goal difference of any of these teams in the race for third. But it's getting harder and harder to trust them on a fortnightly basis, isn't it? Because they're so up and down.
Yeah, I cannot get a handle on this team at all. You have no idea what team is turning up. Just on paper, that midfield of Pituka, Misao, Araki, and forward Doi, Wedo, Everaldo, whoever you want, there's so much quality in it. But there's one week they'll be like absolute world beaters, and the other team, they look like they've never seen each other before. And they've got to get the defence sorted. I think that's, even at their best, it's still a bit of a fragile defence. And with a young goalkeeper behind them, that's clearly the area of weakness. And maybe that's the cause for the inconsistency with young players playing there. But yeah, I mean, you expect a lot better, and you expect the leaders in that team, there's a lot of experience further forward, to kind of get those together and not allow such results to happen. I don't think that's an acceptable result in any circumstance for a Kashima Antlers team. And yeah, I mean, I've said all along, I think that Kobe and Kashima are the best two in this race for this third place, and I'm going to still stick with that, even though Kashima are making it as difficult as possible for me to trust them, as you said. But yeah, I mean, this has to spark a response from Kashima. They cannot allow that to settle. They have to then go on and get victories and get back into the top three, because, it was unacceptable, that performance. But, as you say, it's very hard to trust them, but I'm going to still try and stick with them and say that they'll be right up there. But, yeah, this was horrendous, this 90 minutes.
Yeah, fair enough. So before we leave this group of games and segue on to the relegation dogfight, well, we're going to talk about the team that sunk back to the foot of the table here after their home defeat at the hands of Urawa, Yokohama FC. So Graham Freche asks, is there any hope left with the 10 games to go that the miracle will happen? Yokohama FC, well, they didn't lose any ground on Shonan and Shimizu just outside the drop zone, because both of those teams lost, and indeed even Gumba above them did as well. But, 10 games to go. They've only won 4 all season. They're going to have to win 3 more than Shonan and Shimizu do to try and get out of the drop zone, and that's without Oita, Sendai and Vortis above them having a say in things. So for me, as positive as we have been at times since the Olympic break, it does look like it's just going to be a mission too far, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very difficult for them, and their time is running out, and it looks very unlikely. I thought they played quite well against Aroa, especially that first half or so, where it was kind of end-to-end, and it was one you just needed a little bit more composure, maybe, in front of goal, and they were denied by a couple of decent saves by Nishikawa, so you can see that there is an intent from Yokohama, and you can see that they have the ability, I think, to get a few victories, but 8 points behind with, 10 games to go. It's a difficult ask with other teams to climb above. So I think it's probably too little too late. But I still thought, yeah, they played well and they've given themselves a chance. But you have to convert some decent, positive performances into victories. And they've not really been able to do that.
No, fair enough then. So, yeah, in the race for third then, yeah, important wins for Tosu, Nagoya and Reds. But, yeah, a stunning defeat for Antlers. Well, too little too late for Yokohama FC. As you said earlier on in the episode, Sam, or right back at the start, we wrote off, as a collective, the J-Talk podcast wrote off Sendai and Oita's chances of a survival last week. And so, naturally, they both went out and broke long winless runs in match day 28. So I don't know where our reverse jinxing services are available for hire. Get in touch via Twitter at JTalkPod or via email JTalkPod@yahoo.com. We will reverse jinx anything into existence for you. And that is factually guaranteed. Although I have to claim a small victory here, Sam. I said last week that Vegalta would fancy their chances away at a wobbly Gumbaro Saka side on Sunday. And, a game of the season contender. I mean, this is absolutely brilliant. Kamen Togashi's first goals for Vegalta, a pair of first-half headers 5 minutes apart, were his first J1 goals for 3 years. And, their first win in 12 league games, clinched through Takuma Nishimura's superb 79th-minute winner after Gumba had twice come from behind, saw them score 3 goals in a league game for the first time all season. What a remarkable game this was.
Yeah, it was a pretty epic game, especially after that first goal went in. You know, all hell broke loose, kind of, in this game. I mean, Gamba were awful, absolutely awful. I mean, the defending from... You've got Gen Shoji and Kim Yong-won, two players that have played at World Cups. You expect them to be a lot better than leaving Togashi unmarked, not once, but twice. And it was just horrendous defending. But you've got to give credit to Togashi getting into the position to getting the headers in on goal. And, yeah, two very good goals from him. And it was just a bit wild after that. It had a lot of, we've come on to, I'm sure, the VAR nonsense that lit up the second half, or dowered it, whatever you want to say. But yeah, Vegalta, I mean, first half they didn't really offer too much before their goal, but afterwards, yeah, they kept going. They smelt a bit of weakness, I think, from Gamba. They looked like the better side in that second half, and they were fully worthy, I thought, of the winner in the end. Another good goal from Nishimura. Again, the Gamba defending is next to useless, because he's allowed to wander from halfway up until the 18-yard box pretty much unchallenged. So yeah, it's a worrying result for Gamba, because I don't think they're safe yet, especially if Sendai are going to go on a little bit of a run, and maybe Oita as well. But yeah, it's a really important victory for them, and I thought they played pretty well, especially in that second half. And yeah, you can only beat what's in front of you as well. I mean, Gamba were poor, but that doesn't matter to Sendai. They really, took advantage of it.
Indeed, and you mentioned VAR. So, yeah, in between Gumba's 60th-minute equaliser from Patrick from the penalty spot, in between that and, Takuma Nishimura's 79th-minute winner, I'm not sure how much of this you want to relive, Sam, but, for the sake of... what you tweeted out on Sunday night, yes, we better play the jingle. This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. Okay, so it hasn't happened too many times since VAR's introduction into J1 that, the officiating crew are left with egg on their face. He says it tongue-in-cheek. But, on this particular occasion, with Vegalta up in arms about a penalty of their own that they felt they deserved Yeah, it finally took after how long was it? 5 or 6 minutes. The referee and VAR to discover that there was an offside that cancelled it all out.
Yeah, 5.5 minutes of our time was completely wasted by this. Everyone checking handballs from different angles and whatnot, when all you had to do was check, was he offside in the build-up? And we can stop all this nonsense. I mean, you look at other sports, and I'll take cricket as an example, where any time there's a review in cricket, you check, is the ball legal? That's the first thing you do before you waste your time on anything else. And that surely should be the way that football sets itself up, where you make sure, okay, at least is this allowed to count? And it was the first thing, you could have checked it for 10 seconds and we'd have all moved on with our lives. But instead, and still, even if it wasn't offside, it still took too long, where I think it was like 4 minutes of them just checking the angle. It's a very obvious handball. So why that took so long, and then why the referee then has to go to the monitor? It's all complete waste of time, in my opinion. But yeah, they all look very stupid when it's all offside, and it didn't look like anyone realised that they should have checked that until about 5 minutes in.
This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. All right, well, remarkable stuff. But that hopefully hasn't tarnished, as I said, Sam, one of the games of the season. Because Sendai breaking new ground, as I said, scoring 3 goals in a league game for the first time all season. Togashi breaking a 3-year duck. And I don't know. Are they suddenly going to become more expressive? Are they just going to go for it now with the handbrake off? I don't know, because they're obviously famed as a defensive team first and foremost. But I mean, you know, Togashi was afforded space in the area, especially for his second goal, because I mean, for that cross, they had 4 men in the box. So I mean, there were other problems for the Gumba defense to deal with, rather than Togashi, who was left unmarked, as you said. So I don't know, are they going to hopefully, for the sake of their supporters, they're going to be more expressive in the run-in, or was this just a flash in the pan, similar to Shonan's 5-1 win over Sanezo a couple of weeks ago, that now looks like a complete anomaly?
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily say this is a turning point for a Tegaramuri side, because we haven't really seen much other evidence that he's going to be all-out attack as they kind of got into in this second half. So, yeah, maybe let's see how the game against Shimizu comes along, because, Lotton is not going to go forward. So it is up to Sendai to try and do that. So hopefully, and I think that's the way that they should be going, is that a lot of teams in this league have issues defensively that can be exploited if you just go and attack them. So I think that would be the way to go. They were kind of, in this game, it could have gone another way, and I'd be remiss to not mention that I thought Patrick should have had a penalty for Gamba inside 10 minutes, where he was bundled over from behind, and the referee sort of played advantage but didn't play advantage, and Ona went and missed. But I thought that should have been a penalty, and that could have completely changed this game. But they got that break, they then got their goal, and yeah, they took advantage of that and went on and produced a really positive performance. So hopefully this is a turning point for Sendai and just some more exciting football to come. But yeah, let's wait and see, and it might just be a false dawn.
Yes, indeed. Well, for now, it moves them to within a point of a 17th place to Tokushima. And yes, within 4 of both Shonan and Shimizu, who, as I already mentioned, were both, went winless over the weekend. And Shonan's trip to Oita is the next game we'll cover. And Trinita's first win in 7, it ended 2-0 to the hosts, thanks to goals from Yuta Koide in the first half and Kohei Issa late on, saw them move off the foot of the table and, yes, send Yokohama FC back to the basement. So, Oita have obviously a slightly longer road to hoe, Sam, but, a morale-boosting victory. But again, for Shonan, very much an opportunity missed to pull away ever so slightly from the drop zone.
Yeah, it was a really poor performance from Shonan, a game they probably would have expected to win, or at least get a point out of it. Oita, in the last few weeks, we've said that they've started games pretty well and then faded quite horribly in the second half. But this time, they got their goal early on, they took the lead, and they managed to hold on a lot better than they have been. It might just come down to Shonan being a poorer side. They didn't create a great deal. They didn't really whip in too many crosses for Wellington to deal with. I think there was one chance for Tarek El-Yanoussi, which was then straight at the goalkeeper. But yeah, they're kind of without a lot of creativity, I think, shown. And they've changed their manager and got Yamaguchi in, Bin Okushima left. And they're playing kind of more functional players, I think, with like Kobayashi at right wing back, where Okamoto, I mean, he gets no look, but at least he causes a few problems. And he looks, creates chances. And I don't think Kobayashi really offers the same. And Shintaro Nago's missed the last few games. No Tiger Hatta as well, another of their good young players. So they're kind of missing that little spark. It was really lacking in this game. And they caused their own downfall with a second goal where... defensive error, but miscommunication really with Sugioka, and then Oiwa and Issa nicks in the head of both of them and goes on and wraps up the game for Oita. So, yeah, really good result for them. A worrying one for Shonan, just 3 points ahead of the drop zone. And, Yokohama are coming for you, Shonan. I'm going to beat Scott McIntyre.
All right, then. Yeah, okay, and there was another question from Grant Frecce about the Gumba Sendai game that I didn't ask you directly, Sam, but I think we have answered in passing. So, Grant Frecce, hopefully our discussion on the Gumba Sendai game sufficed. And that leaves us with just one game to go then. It was a mid-table clash between Cerezo Osaka and Sapporo. And if that sounds familiar, listeners, well, yeah, that's it's a rematch of last Wednesday's rearranged fixture. In this one, Consadole got revenge for their home defeat at the hands of Cerezo in midweek, but a 2-0 win for the visitors wasn't enough as Cerezo edged through on away goals 3-3, although it did move Sapporo up two spots to 10th above both Hiroshima and Cerezo in the table. So much to say about this game, Sam. I guess, a win for each team on their opponent's patch. They both move on with their seasons in mid-table mediocrity.
Yeah, it didn't really mean anything in the grand scheme of things. It was a decent watch, actually. I thought Sapporo played very well. As they usually do, they went forward well. They were kind of relentless in the way they attacked in this game and were full value for their victory. Cerezo, maybe with one eye on the Champions League, they didn't really commit too much forward. They didn't really create too many chances until towards the end of the game. So, yeah, it was a very well-deserved victory for Sapporo. But let's hope Cerezo were just keeping something back for the ACL.
And speaking of the ACL, we will finish the episode with a brief look ahead at what's to come on Tuesday in the ACL. Nagoya will host a Daegu of South Korea at 6 p.m. Then at 8 o'clock, it's the big one with the Ulsan of South Korea hosting Kawasaki, an absolute barn burner that promises to be. Then Cerezo, coming off that defeat at the hands of Sapporo. Will entertain Pohang of South Korea at 6 o'clock on Wednesday night. And then after that, J1 will be back, of course, with the weekend's fixtures. There are 10 games to go in the season, and in match day 29, we'll get going with a Kyushu derby on Friday night with the Tosu hosting Oita. Then the other 9 games are all on Saturday, including what I'm sure is Sam's pick of the weekend, Nagoya hosting Yokohama F. Marinos at the Toyota Stadium. So that's a 4th hosting 2nd. Any other games that you'd like to pinpoint, Sam, before... some kind of interesting-looking games without really setting the world on fire, perhaps. But obviously, with that said, it's going to be a rip-roaring weekend, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think there's some interesting games on there. I think just as a neutral to watch Kobe, Sapporo should be a really open game, a really exciting one. I'd expect a few goals there. Let's see what Team Kobe can put out and then if it's the one that can blow away teams and or whatnot, or one that struggles. You never really know, a bit like with Kashima. So that looks like an exciting game. And Oh, yeah. Let's say Kashima and Gamba as well after their performances this week. Both, yeah, fighting for something at either end of the table. It's a traditionally very big clash. And, yeah, it should be an interesting one. And at the moment, I'd be backing Kashima to bounce back and put Gamba away, which I think has guaranteed a Gamba victory. So sorry about that, Kashima fans. But, yeah, yeah, I think there are still some good ones open. Are you looking forward to Tokyo against Yokohama FC? Nagatomo's... re-debut.
Yeah, hopefully he'll be involved. Looking forward to an FC Tokyo game, and me, they don't really go together these days, but yeah, I'll check it out, and hopefully Tokyo will do the business against the bottom team in the table, but certainly no guarantees whatsoever. So just before we finally wrap things up, it has been another epic episode of the podcast that we hope you've all enjoyed, listeners. Yeah, I mean, it's the obvious choice for match of the weekend, so how do you think Nagoya Yokohama F. Marinos will go on Saturday night? Grampus, not in terms of the numbers, in terms of goals conceded, not technically the best defence in the league, Sam, but as we mentioned earlier, their 18th clean sheet of the campaign. They've already set the new J1 record with 10 games to go, albeit, of course, this is an elongated season with 20 teams, caveat. But they probably appear the best equipped team to stop F. Marinos at this point of proceeding. So will that be Massimo Ficcadenti's first objective? And do you think they can cause F. Marinos and their patchwork defensive setup some serious problems on the other end?
They absolutely can. It's very similar to when we were discussing the Kawasaki games earlier in the season, where Nagoya defensively can, at their best, keep out any side. And in the Kawasaki game, they just made rare errors, which was a bit strange for a Nagoya team. But at their best, yeah, they can keep even Marinos out. And they've got players up front. If you play Fair Shock and you've got Mateus and Maeda and all those, they can cause problems, especially if Thiago Martins is out again. But I do worry about Nagoya in terms of the way they approach those Kawasaki games, and especially in that first one, they kind of got torn apart. Plus, they've got the ACL game in midweek, so they're going to have to play their best team in that one. And yeah, I think tiredness may creep up on them, especially with the relentless way that Marinos play their football and will move them around. So yeah, I think while it is possible that Nagoya could hold them out, and they've definitely got the record that shows that they could do that, I fancy Yokohama to just have too much for them, yeah, and run away with an away victory.
Yeah, I mean, it should be said that, yeah, they've conceded 21 goals all season, Nagoya, and a third of them came in those two back-to-back games against Kawasaki. They conceded 7 in two games. Apart from that, yes, they have been the clean sheet machine that we got to know and love last season. But yeah, in the reverse fixture in the middle of August, F. Marinos ran out 2-0 victors at Mitsuzawa. So, yeah, obviously F. Marinos and all of their supporters listening will be hoping for a repeat of that game. I don't know, Sam, are there any sort of lessons that you think Grampus can learn defensively from that particular game?
From that game, yeah, they were just generally not up to it, I don't think. It was just a game where Nagoya didn't turn up. And so I think, yeah, if they have a little bit more focus, I think that's the main thing. They've got to be a lot more focused, because the way that Marinos play their football, and it's all about movement, you've got to be vigilant and you've got to keep your eye on everything, and you can't switch off for any length of time. So they've got to improve on that, and I'm sure they will do. Ficcadenti rarely lets a poor defensive performance pass without kind of tightening things up. So I'm sure they'll be a little bit more switched on in this game. It's just, I'm worried about kind of mental fatigue in the way that they've got to come back from it. It's going to be a big game in midweek against Daegu in the Champions League. They've got to put a lot of energy into that, and Daegu will cause them problems. We saw against Kawasaki, they've got goals in them, Daegu, and they've got good attacking players. So for Nagoya to have to come through that and then go and play against Yokohama, I think it's a really tough ask for them. But if they're absolutely switched on, then I don't see any reason why Nagoya can't keep them out. But yeah, I'm still going to favour Yokohama.
Yeah, fair enough then. So, yeah, that's our choice for pick of the weekend. And as Sam said, there are a few other hidden gems on the Match Day 29 fixture list. Unfortunately for the listeners, although fortunately for Sam, he won't be involved in next week's episode as he takes some time off with some family visiting. So, Sam, we certainly hope you make the most of your time off and enjoy yourself and then come back refreshed in a couple of weeks. So, yes, I can exclusively reveal that Johnny Nicol will be joining me on the next week's episode to run through everything in Match Day 29. So, looking forward to hearing from Johnny, and I'm sure you're looking forward to a break, mate.
I am. It's been a while, but I'm looking forward to that, and looking forward to listening to you and Johnny next week. I hope Johnny has a good episode, but not too good an episode, because I do want my job to stay safe. But, yeah, I am really looking forward to it. It does look like a really good set of fixtures, I think, to get into, so I will try and catch up with them at some point. But, yeah, looking forward to listening to you guys next week.
Well, yeah, I tell you what, if FC Tokyo lose to Yokohama FC and Gumba lose again, it might be a pretty a pretty sour podcast. Might only go for about 5 minutes, but we'll wait and see. We'll cross our fingers and hope that our respective teams win. And we'll be back to round it all up next week. So as I said, Sam, enjoy your time off, and we'll speak again soon. So that's it for this week's episode of the JTalk podcast. Our thanks to Dan Olowitz for all his input in part one. Absolutely terrific to catch up with him again. Thanks to Graham Freche for his questions throughout part two. And thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. Last week, I mentioned that Rascal and Nathan had come on board, and in the past week, Dan has done the same. So, terrific to have him on board as well. If you'd like to get involved and support the podcast for as little as $1 a month, please head to patreon.com/jtalkpod. All right, so yes, we'll leave it there, and Johnny Nicol will join me next week to round up all of the Match Day 29 action. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.